We explore his enormous contribution to music today on this edition of the Music Archive Showcase.
Don't hate the black, don't hate the white. If you get bitten, just hate the bite.
Hi, this is Paul Ingles, and I'm standing here in my home studio watching a YouTube clip that the Ed Sullivan curators have put up for everyone to see online of Sly and the Family Stone's appearance on the famous variety show on December 29th, 1968, and there is positively no way that I wasn't watching this very event live that night when I would have been 12 years old, and all of our favorite rock and pop music stars were showing up on the weekly Sunday night entertainment parade hosted by Ed Sullivan. Holiday break, after all. No school on Monday. Of course I was there, watching the psychedelically dressed seven-piece band Sly and the Family Stone. Sly Stone on the left side, shirtless, save for an open-chested, deep burgundy tassel-fringed vest hanging on his slender shoulders. 8-inch-high afro and prominent side chops. He's pounding on an organ. Sister Rose Stone, just a few feet away from him, is in a royal purple, buttoned-up, uniform-style top coat mini-dress with a bright red sash across her chest, her wig dyed light purple to match it, playing an electric piano. Behind them on risers, Cynthia Robinson is in a bright yellow mini-dress and matching leggings, blowing her trumpet like there's no tomorrow, and long-haired sax man Jerry Martini is honking on his sax in a burnt orange tuxedo with a ruffled shirt just to her left. A few feet away, drummer Greg Errico is in a full suit too, all light purple. Stone family brother Freddie is dressed in orange overalls and a patchwork shirt. He's singing back up and thumping a chicken scratch rhythm on his solid body electric guitar, with Larry Graham just next to him in a sequined purple and gold cape slapping his bass. The band has already managed to squeeze four of their hit songs into just the first 4 minutes of their 6-minute medley on the show. Suddenly, Sly and Rose join hands and sprint away from their keyboards into the audience, right into the aisle, and start dancing wildly with each other. The uptight, mostly white Sullivan Theater audience sits stiffly, even when Sly asks for audience participation on the chorus.
If you'd sing along with Rose, we'd appreciate it now. I wanna take you higher.
After a full minute in the crowd, Sly gets maybe a tenth of the audience members to clap along before he breaks into a chest and thigh slap rhythm routine.
Don't slap!
Done with that, he slaps hands with one of the few black members in the audience and both bounce back to the stage for the last minute of the jam. By now, Freddie and Larry are doing a choreographed alternating foot shuffle that looks borrowed from James Brown, while they both still play furiously. As Sly stands behind the organ, he conducts, he still plays, he sings, and hollers through the closing measures.
Thank you for letting us be ourselves! Thank you!
With their just-released single, Everyday People, already climbing the charts, this performance helped rocket that song to become their first number one hit and cement Sly and the Family Stone's position toward the top of the American rock, pop, and soul scene for the next 3 years. On today's program, we'll chart that magical climb that included 10 memorable hits and will mark the quick slump that followed the band in the 1970s and virtual disappearance of band leader Sly Stone from actively making much more music in the many decades that followed. This is Sly and the Family Stone, Taking Us Higher, and we'll be joined by a panel of music writers, educators, and musicians, along with archival interviews from key members of the band, to guide us through this hour when we'll play all the great songs straight through for you. But here's just a sampler of where we'll be taking your ears and spirits this hour.
I mean, he gave us a soundtrack in a very short period of time that in some ways allowed us to transcend what was probably most chaotic periods in American history outside of the Civil War.
We should all dance to the music. Sly Stone, funky as he was using music to really deliver a better way to be in the world. Right? We are all everyday people.
You love me, you hate me, you know me, and then you can figure out the bag I'm in. I am everyday people. Yeah.
Sly Stone was so incredibly prescient and threw together a band that was like multi-gendered, multi-racial, on purpose. In 1966, you know, and that's another thing that I think is incredible about the original Sly and the Family Stone.
Yeah, you've been sitting much too long. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. Stand.
It's kind of ironic because I think, you know, Sly's life devolved into such a mess. But those early records, there's such an incredible positivity about them.
I think Take You Higher was a reference to elevating your spirit, elevating your consciousness.
Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again. That whole song is just a devastating portrait of where Sly was at in his head, but also where he saw the culture going. It's some of the best written lyrics of that era.
The empowerment of you can make it if you try.
You can make it if you try. You can make it if you try. Push harder, a little deeper. Don't let the traffic bring you down.
You know, I go to Hot Fun in the summertime because that was always kind of the slinky, shuffly. You could really have fun on a dance floor when they played it. I think just it felt good.
There was a big change in Sly in 1971 when There's a Riot Going On came out, which of course was the answer to Marvin Gaye saying, what's going on? There's a riot going on.
So much of that album about America, the state that America is in. Family Affair, one of the songs on that album about two children fighting, and it's not quite resolved. I mean, again, that could not just come from the church, but right from the Bible. I mean, the Bible begins with the story of Cain and Abel.
Both kids are good and wrong. Blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair. It's a family affair.
Another aspect of Sly and the Family Stone's music is certainly wanting to depart, wanting to go away, wanting to escape, but something's holding him back. And I think it seems like a recurring theme, not just in Sly Stone's music, but also in Sly Stone's life as well. If you want me to stay. It's very different, very special keyboard line, and how Sly Stone was ahead of the game in terms of playing with drum machines and synthesized sounds in a way that few people were at that time, especially few people in popular music.
When you see me again, I hope that you have been the kind of person that you really are now. We got to get in straight. How could I ever be late when you're my woman taking up my time?
But I know he changed my life, and he wrenched my life. And I can't imagine my life without Sly Stone. No way. Everyday People is a integral element of every speech I give. The dignity and sanctity of everyday people. Those James Cleveland called ordinary people. How do they muster the courage to lift their voices in such a way that they can shape their destiny? How do they forge some sense of who they are in the face of hatred and thereby not succumb to that kind of hatred? How are they treated indecently and teach America the meaning of decency? How are they treated anti-democratically and teach America the meaning of democracy? Like Douglas, like Martin King, like Louis Armstrong, like Sly Stone. And Sly created a music that became a place where we could go and have a foretaste of that freedom, of that democratic experience, even though we couldn't live it on the ground.
Our opening montage from Sly and the Family Stone was concluded by thoughts on Sly Stone from Dr. Cornel West, philosopher, African studies professor, and activist, taken from a Michael Rubenstein documentary called On the Sly, In Search of the Family Stone. Also, you heard our panel of music writers and educators pitching in their thoughts, too, and we'll have them introduce themselves the next time you hear from them as we move through this celebration and exploration of the importance of the music of Sly and the Family Stone, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers whose star shone most brightly between 1967 and 1970 on the U.S. and global music scene.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tammy Kernodle, a University Distinguished Professor of Musicology at Miami University, where I teach and research in the area of African-American music, but also gender studies in music.
I'm Greg McVicker. I'm a radio guy, grew up in the Bay Area. In fact, was born in Oakland and grew up in the suburbs just across the hills from Oakland.
Hi, my name is Aaron Cohen. I teach humanities at City Colleges of Chicago. And I am the author of Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power.
I think the fact that much of Sly and the Family Stone's story as a group being rooted and grounded in what was the experience of San Francisco and Oakland is so important is because we don't look at those cities as being part of this conversation about the Great Migration and Black people from the Deep South and from the Midwest moving to the West Coast. And those cities were incubators. They were incubators for the blues culture that came out of Texas. They were incubators for the jazz culture that came out of the Midwest and the gospel culture that came from both of those. But they were also incubators for, this multi-ethnic, multicultural mix that was part of the California experience prior to the Great Migration.
I mean, Oakland has this vibe, I mean, this cultural impact on anything near it that I think has become a part of my musical DNA. Like, if you listen to my mixes, it's always got some funk in it and, you know, maybe there's some of those church gospel vocal kind of influences.
One of the interesting things about Sly Stone is always tied in with the church from the very beginning of his recorded career when he was a very young person with the Stuart Four, his family gospel group, and Walking in Jesus' Name from, I believe, 1952. You know, he's a boy.
I'm gonna walk out
in my Jesus' name. I've been false accused so many times, I bear the blame. I'm gonna live a Christian life, God knows I'm not ashamed. You know I'm gonna keep walking, talking, praying, singing, teaching in my Jesus' name.
His group, Sly and the Family Stone, brought his background in the Sanctified Church, that musical, social, cultural, and religious tradition, into the funk era, into the era of psychedelic rock, so to speak. Essentially, as out there as Sly and the Family Stone got, they musically and lyrically were still very much tied to the Pentecostal church, even in the latter 60s, not through everything they did, but through much of what they did. And I think that is something about Sly and the Family Stone that really needs to be heightened.
Another early recorded chapter of Sly Stone's musical journey included a few singles from his doo-wop group called the Viscaines, about 10 years after those 1952 family gospel recordings we heard. Well, this recording is Sly Stone in high school with his Filipino buddy Fran Arellano in the otherwise all-white doo-wop group, the Viscaines. Sly in an integrated ensemble even back then. Their recording of the song called Yellow Moon. And Sly also cut some local singles under the name Danny Stewart, like this one, A Long Time Alone. Again, early 1960s here.
Won't you?
In the 1960s, if it was about music in the Bay Area, Sylvester Stewart, a.k.a. Sly Stone, was into it, like installing himself at one of the region's all-soul radio stations, KSOL.
He was a DJ. You know, really high-energy soul station. Pretty fantastic.
438 of the Sly Stone Show. I'm Sly. Been here for about 2 years now. You know what, man? I haven't had a vacation since I've been here. I haven't had one vacation, man. I take off every other day. Whoever had that voice, they got a fantastic voice. Bernadette must dig it.
Here's Sly recalling his radio days in an early 1970s local TV interview.
Well, one thing on the radio, we had dedications. And Willie Popcorn and Tamale, those are some of the names that dedicated, you know.
I want to dedicate to Jeannie Bell.
You know, those kind of things. And I'd write on the radio. That's what I did a lot of times. I wrote behind a board. Songs, and I'd, you know, make notes.
And at the same time, Sly was producing other artists.
And then Tom Donahue gave me a chance to produce that. Actually, I was making $35 a week. I mean, I had to produce or steal or beg or borrow. There was a group called the Bo Brummels, and they had a song called Laugh, Laugh, and then I, that one, I produced them. Back on it, I became a producer. No, I don't like the way that sounds in order to survive, because I could get a job, I could be on the radio, you know, to live. That's what I mean, not to survive, to live. I liked that life, producing. Jerry Martini is the guy that really started it. This guy, he plays saxophone in the group now. And he came to the radio station and decided that, Sly, you ought to be the leader of this group. And I was doing fine at the radio station, I thought. So we started looking around for everybody other than my sisters and my brother, because they were automatically in if I was in, because Daddy said so.
Among those others they looked to find for this group to be were drummer Greg Errico, bassist Larry Graham, and trumpet powerhouse Cynthia Robinson, who had met this Sylvester Stewart when he was a teenager, but had lost touch and had no idea he was the dude she was hearing on the radio station.
I happened to run into a guitar player, Martinez, and found out he was from Vallejo. And he says, so I said, hey, do you know, my chance, did you ever know Sylvester Stewart? And he goes, yeah, yeah. He says, I said, well, you know what he's doing now? Yeah, I think he's a big time disc jockey up north. And I go, oh, where? He said, yeah, he's a disc jockey in San Francisco. I said, is he on KSOL? And he goes, cause that was Sly Stone. So I didn't know they were the same person, but I was fooling with the radio and I came across him and he was talking, people were calling up Willie Popcorn and Tamale and they were dedicating songs. I said, oh, that's great. You know, and then there was one period where he was doing a X-Lax commercial and I heard the toilet flush in the background. I went, whoa. So
I'm breaking.
That was Sly.
So I started listening to KSOL. So I went nuts.
Yeah.
You know, I made sure that my boyfriend at the time, we were writing songs for other groups. And so we had this one for the Chromatics. And I said, I know who Sly Stone is. And he goes, oh, you're lying. I said, no, I know who he is. I want to say hi to him. And don't bring the record. I just want to say hi to him. So we go up there and he remembered me, you know, and he was very, very nice to me. And then they kind of kept on going from there.
We started off rehearsing in my parents' home.
Here's Freddie Stone at the induction of Sly and the Family Stone into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993.
Working every day, 8 hours a day. We'd rehearse all day long, bring our sack lunches. We just work and we honed our craft and we worked and we polished it and we re-shined it and dirtied it up and polished it and re-honed it and everything. We did it for over a year until we thought we were ready to go out and face the public and whatever, you know, was in store for us.
One, two, three, four!
Yeah, hi, I'm Greg Codd. I'm the co-host of Sound Opinions, the podcast and nationally syndicated public radio show. I think a whole new thing gets overlooked when people talk about their discography. That was the debut album. It didn't really sell a lot of copies. None of the songs were really singles. The record company apparently didn't like it either because it didn't pop. First of all, the title, A Whole New Thing. And I was a big Ornette Coleman fan, and it reminded me a lot of Ornette saying Change of the Century or The Shape of Jazz to Come. Like he was making this really radical music in the late 50s, early 60s, and he was basically naming it like, you may not be prepared for this, but here we are. And I think Sly had the same thought in mind when he made A Whole New Thing. I mean, you had advice with those complicated horn lines. You know, those horn lines were incredibly innovative.
One of these days you're gonna take off my shoes, you're gonna bring me the paper so I can read the news. I'm gonna love you so good, I'm gonna blow your mind, the thought of my love will occupy all your time.
I mean, there was so much going on. And I think Sly kind of recognized, yeah, this is probably a little too much for, you know, the general public to absorb. And he wanted to be popular. You know, he wanted people to relate to his music. That was what it was all about. We're all in this together.
We heard Chicago music writer and radio host Greg Kot sizing up a little of the work on Sly and the Family Stone's very first album called A Whole New Thing. Adventurous, prescient of what the band could do, but a commercial flop in the fall of 1967. So CBS Records exec Clive Davis told Sly, make the next one more commercial, why don't you? Which most of you know by now that they did, starting with the release of the advance single to what would be that next album, just a little over a month after the band's first LP. I was 11 at the time, listening to something coming out of my radio that was impossible to ignore, impossible not to totally love. We'll be right back.
some bottom so that the dancer just won't hide.
It's Greg Cottigan, the co-host of Sound Opinions.
Hi again, it's LA-based musician John Spurney.
I'm Greg McVicker. I'm a radio guy, grew up in the Bay Area.
So then you go to Dance to the Music, which is, you know, that took it over the top, a conscious attempt to be more of a pop artist, and it worked very well.
It's like a fanfare that draws you in. And that it's you know, Cynthia saying, "Get up! And dance to the music." Like, it's just like, come on. It's like she's literally saying to you, you know, here we go.
Cynthia's like, "All the squares go home." You know, it's like, and he was telling her, you know, I want you to respond to this, but I don't want you to sing it. I want you to talk it. So he's introducing you to the band in that song. And at the same time, creating this incredibly energetic song that gets people out of their seats.
We're a community of musicians and we're all making this collective sound with you, you know, let's all dance kind of a thing. They also had this kind of open, sparse arrangement, so you could hear all the individual instruments. You know, you could hear the little frills and riffs and ornamentations nice and clearly, all just anchored with this heavy, heavy beat. And then Sly just riffing over the top with this wonderful, kind of optimistic, playful sense of humor. Great stuff. I'm getting excited just thinking about it. I think it gave people a sense of unity. That's why it's good party music. It brings people together and just this sense of, hey, let's, you know, turn this table over and make a dance floor or some kind of a protest or something. You know, there's something going on.
Indeed, there was suddenly something going on from Sly and the Family Stone. And over the next couple of years, especially, everyone would know about it. And we'll hear about just some of the impact this band's music had on the larger music scene when we continue with our special, Sly and the Family Stone, Taking Us Higher, right after this break. Punk rock pioneer Sly Stone passed away June 9, 2025, at the age of 82. We continue our exploration into his enormous contribution to music on today's edition of the Music Archive Showcase. You're listening to Sly and the Family Stone, Taking Us Higher, an appreciation of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band that made their mark on the music scene with a relatively brief but very influential run of hits from early 1968 to 1973. I'm Paul Ingles with our expert panel of musicians, music writers, and music educators, here to dig down below the surface understanding that this band was just great, to help us understand why it was great, how it managed to have so much influence on soul and funk and pop music for decades to come. With the band's second album, named after their hit single Dance to the Music, L.A. musician John Spurney tells us how a whole new genre called psychedelic soul was born, thanks to this second album from Sly and the Family Stone.
You know, Motown goes through this period in the late 60s of starting to make psychedelic soul records, you know, like all those Temptations records like Psychedelic Shack and Ball of Confusion, and those would not happen without Sly. And those records are incredible. Don't get me wrong, but that is, you know, people, producers in an office going, you know, we got to catch up. Like, this is what's happening now, and we need to make records like this. And you can just feel the Sly influence. It's so heavy, but it's really obvious that they were trying to emulate what Sly and the Family Stone were doing.
Hey, from New York City, from John Kruth, musician and multi-instrumentalist and music writer and lover of the music. I saw Sly, and I saw him at a little skating arena, and it was a spark, and it was on fire, and it went through the crowd with an energy that there was very little like it that I had ever experienced before or since.
Sometimes I'm right, but I can be wrong. My own beliefs are in my song. The butcher, the baker, the drummer, and then makes no difference what group I'm in. I am everyday people.
Its time had come when he was singing about Black power or Black civil rights, because that's what he was doing. He was saying, look, I don't care. There's a short one. There's a fat one. There's a skinny one. He didn't care if you were green, purple, red, or blue with orange polka dots. People are people. Everyday people. I'm everyday people. He sang that song to bring the peace, and man, we need that more than ever now.
Hi, I'm Holly Gleason, editor and contributor of Prine on Prine, Interviews and Encounters with John Prine. I came from kind of a high-impact home, so sometimes there would be some not-so-happy nonsense going on before I got in the car. But if I got in the car and everyday people was on, like, everything, it just vaporized. Because, you know, he's basically saying, whoever you are, that's a solid groove. Feel it, do it, be it, and let's just all be cool with each other.
You were one of the first black musicians to have a wide range of audience. A lot of white people followed your music and bought your music. Why do you suppose your music did that?
I think it has to do with songs that involve everybody and a message that involves everybody. Everybody wants to be happy, and the songs that we do are songs that I feel should make everybody happy.
So you have up music, would you say?
I'd say so.
In the end, you'll still be you. One that's done all the things you set out to do.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere.
The things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. Stand.
There's a midget standing tall,
and the giant beside him about to fall.
Hi again, it's Dr. Tammy Kernodle, professor of African American Music, Miami University. Based on how you heard it, where you were at that time, you could fill in the blanks as to what you were being asked to stand against. But the real power of that song, it was a call against apathy. You know, it was a collective call for people to stand, and you find what it is that you feel like you need to stand about. It was the echo to the call that Kennedy gave in 1960 when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. So when Sly Stone comes years later and sings that song, Stand, Stand, a whole generation heard that. That was a call. That was a resurrection from the spirit of the carnage and the violence and the disillusionment that had set in by 1967, 68, 69. It was a call and a rebirth of a consciousness to stand. But what he did was he didn't wrap that in a sound that wasn't going to be accessible. He wrapped that in some gospel, in some pop, in some rock.
You know, these were all songs that, you know, the lyrics, I could hear them in a sermon. And it wasn't just through that era's sense of empowerment or that era's sense of paranoia that came from the latter 60s, early 70s, but also messages coming from his own background in the church.
And he focused it completely on Stand, which to me is one of the masterpieces of the era. That had a ton of hit singles on it. And the funk on that record is just so strong. You know, he had an amazing bass player, Larry Graham. Graham developed a style of bass playing that just everybody emulated from that point on. You know, just the percussiveness of that bass sound was so huge.
Loved black music. I loved Earth, Wind, and Fire and the Commodores before Lionel Richie found that ballad sold records and P-Funk and Rufus. And part of it was I had a very cool babysitter, but part of it was it just felt so good to me in my solar plexus. And I think it starts here. It really does. He was walking the walk. He had women in his band playing real instruments, holding down key parts of the songs. He had white people. He had Latin people. He had black people. Everybody that was in that band, you could tell by the focus, there was no window dressing. There was nobody there for central casting. They were there because they were beasts on the bandstand. And when he was playing I Want to Take You Higher, every single one of them was pushing every single one of them.
I'm talking.
I'm walking.
I'm walking. Hey, hey,
hey. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, now.
When you see Questlove's Summer of Love and you see what those guys do on stage, and it's a whole celebration of how empowering and powerful black music was. But when those guys take the stage, that's their stage. Like, they own it. Everybody else, thanks for stopping by.
By the summer of 1969, the success of the Stand album, plus a string of high-charting singles and their multi-genre, multi-racial appeal all allowed Sly and the Family Stone to headline historic festivals like the summer concert series known as the Harlem Cultural Festival in New York City's Harlem, that Holly Gleason referred to as the Summer of Soul a moment ago. That's the name of the Questlove 2021 documentary assemblage of that long-lost footage. Sly and the Family Stone headlined the June 29th show in Harlem, and about 6 weeks later, they were the top attraction in the middle of the night at the legendary Woodstock Festival, just about an hour north in Bethel, New York. Here again is writer and radio host Greg Codd.
Musically incredibly diverse, anthemic songs, singles, like you couldn't believe, right before Woodstock, he puts out Hot Fun in the Summertime. I mean, it's just a perfect song for a summer rock festival. You know, it's kind of like gets everybody thinking about what we can do together.
End of the spring, and here she comes back. High, 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 hey. Them summer days, those summer days. That's when I had.
At the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, as it was originally called, weeks later, Sly and the Family Stone had been selected to headline the final night of the three-day event that had grown to monstrous, nearly 500,000 people proportions. Here's Sly and the Family Stone drummer Greg Errico talking about it on Scott Goldfein's Truth in Rhythm podcast, which you can find on YouTube or online at funkinstuff.net.
We were supposed to go on at 8 p.m. that evening on Saturday, and that we didn't end up going on until 3 a.m. because the show was running behind. But that was a challenge for us because all those people were there since, this is Saturday evening, right? And they were there since, I think, Thursday, raining, mud, sun, hot. They're beat up. And we got to go out and perform. You know, they're in their sleeping bags and enough already, right? And so we all kind of like just, you know, grabbed each other's hands and looked at each other and just, okay, this is what we're going to do, and went out to give it all.
Ron Petras and his brother Mike had driven from Cleveland to Woodstock and had managed to survive to see and hear Sly and the Family Stone at 3 in the morning on that memorable early, early Sunday.
I think one of the coolest things was when Sly Stone played I Want to Take You Higher, and I was up on top of the hill at the time, and you can hear the music, but it was kind of faint to a certain degree. And then they started the thing, I Want to Take You Higher, and everybody was throwing up the peace sign or the fist in the air for power. And that was really cool because people on top of it, I mean, could you imagine, like, you saw the group of people. Everybody was doing it, and everybody was yelling, higher. And toward the end, I mean, you were just so pumped up because, I mean, it just, this went on for like 10 minutes or something, you know?
Larry Graham was then bass man for Sly and the Family Stone.
You know how people, when they want you to come back, an encore, I mean, they stand up and they yell, but 500,000 people doing that is really something. I had never heard anything like that in my life. I mean, it's something to really get the heart pumping, you know, and I'll really never forget that feeling, you know, when we walked back out on the stage and the volume of the crowd went even higher. It was so intense, you know, and then we struck up playing the encore and it was like, wow, you know, and we just knew that was a turning point. You know, that's where you leave off the stage and you go back to the trailer and you can't finish hugging each other, you know, and jumping up and down, hey, you know. I'll carry that energy back to the trailer. So that was, and it turned out to be a turning point. That's when really the world on a large scale became aware of Sly and the Family Stone.
Boy, I think you're higher, higher. Now, if you throw the peace sign up and say higher, get everybody to do it. There's a whole lot of people here, and a whole lot of people might not want to do it because if they can somehow get around it, they feel that there are enough people to make up for it. And on, et cetera, et cetera. Ah. We're going to try higher again if we get everybody to join. We'd appreciate it. It'll do you no harm. Wanna dig it higher,
higher.
Way up on the hill, let's try one now, y'all. Wanna dig it higher,
higher.
Wanna dig it higher,
higher.
Hi, John Kreuth here, speaking from New York City, Bleecker Street. We went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. And to me, it was just like a big warehouse filled with some interesting things. I mean, sure, it was great to see Ringo's drums and Brian Jones' dulcimer and one of Eric Clapton's guitar, all that stuff. I was like, yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Nothing really struck me until I walked around this corner and there was Sly's vest from Woodstock. And I found myself on my knees, bowing down to it instantly. I just dropped to my knees and bowed to that relic. Perhaps I didn't really know how deeply Sly affected me until that moment.
And then later in the year, I think the single, greatest single ever released in popular music. Thank you for letting me be myself again. And everybody is a star. So he puts that out at the end of 69 and everything changes.
That song has this gospel element, you know, fighting with the devil, you know, very dark, trying to leave somewhere. He's trying to get away from somewhere, but he really can't.
We begin to wrestle.
it's some of the best written lyrics of that era, you know, R&B, funk, soul. I don't know if that gets proper credit lyrically for how sophisticated it could be. You know, Bob Dylan was the great songwriter of that era, right? Whatever, lyrics of that level. But Sly was very much at that level, I think, with a song like this. That last couplet, dying young is hard to take, selling out is harder. And I thought about that line for a long time. What does that mean, you know? And it doesn't mean something good, I don't think, you know? It's kind of like, you know, and you can live your whole life wrestling with that. And I think it was also Sly wrestling with that concept. Like, he's trying to figure it out. What's my mission here? So basically that song, that brilliant piece of music, is the only thing he releases between like the summer of 69 and the fall of 71. You know, suddenly there's this silence, you know.
Well, that silence from Sly was broken by a late 1971 release of the album called There's a Riot Going On, which by itself marked a pivot from the previous four upbeat Family Stone album titles of Whole New Thing, Dance to the Music, Life, and Stand. Riot had the song Family Affair on it that we sampled earlier as a number one single, and one lesser hit called Running Away. In all these years since, the Riot album has been loved by critics, but at the time proved a difficult listen by the band's longtime fans. The LP hid, or perhaps mirrored, the end of the 60s disillusionment that many were feeling, dissension rising among Sly and the Family Stone's group members, most played only sparingly on this album. Also, ramping up drug use, especially by Sly Stone, was becoming a factor, and on tour, the beginning of a series of Sly Stone late arrivals and no-shows tarnished the band's brand. From that point on, there were sparse, noteworthy tracks on sporadic Sly Stone albums, and the band itself basically dissolved by 1975. Sly Stone passed away June 9th, 2025, at the age of 82. Having celebrated the group's stunning heydays in this hour, we have crafted an optional second hour with more of the group and Sly Stone's story. You'll hear it either right here on this channel or on demand by putting in a search on your browser that starts with these letters, PRX. That's PRX. Then add Sly and Taking Us Higher, and you'll find streamable audio from the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks to all of our contributors for this program, Holly Gleason, Greg Cott, John Kruth, Aaron Cohen, Tammy Kernodal, John Spurney, Greg McVicker, and Scott Goldfein. I'm Paul Ingalls, and thanks to you for listening.
It's World Cafe. Hey, I am Kaleo. Today, we